Welcome to today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is my colleague Joe Healy, and we are here to wrap up what was an exciting week 10 of college baseball. A couple big SEC series as Vanderbilt beat Mississippi State and Arkansas beat South Carolina. Those are both top 10 showdowns. Baylor upset Texas Tech. And there was some big comings and goings in Conference USA, or goings-ons, I suppose, in Conference USA in a couple of those series. So we're going to get into all of that and more here on today's show. But first, the Baseball America College Podcast is presented by Rapsodo. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. Coaches use Rapsodo data as a measuring stick for player development and evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national-database. All right, Joe, it was an exciting weekend of baseball around the country. We had a couple big time top 10 SEC series that, you know, I mentioned, won by Arkansas and Vanderbilt, those were very exciting. You were able to be at one of those as Arkansas beat South Carolina in a series that feels like it happened 2 weeks ago. But when they run these Thursday to Saturday series, sometimes it already feels like they happened a long time ago. By the time we get here to Monday, they're just sometimes so much happens on Sunday. You're like, oh yeah, that's right, that series. It was actually this weekend. It ended on Saturday, but this time, you know, with a Thursday to Saturday series being pushed up, as Arkansas was against South Carolina by rain, so they finished it Friday night. I mean, it really sometimes gets lost, but you were there, so I know it didn't get lost for you. And it was a top 10 series, so it had some significant implications. And yeah, so I just what a. You have some thoughts, I'm sure, about seeing Arkansas in person. I think that was also your first time at Founders Park there in Columbia, one of the gems of college baseball. So, you know, take it kind of wherever you want it with regards to the Hogs and the Gamecocks.
Well, I'm going to start in the obvious place, and that's the video board in left field seems too high. I slacked you this at the beginning of the weekend, and, you know, it was hard to convey what I meant. But it's like the stanchions are like, I don't know, like 6 to 8 feet too high. Like, and I don't know, maybe that's just me. Maybe, you know, part of it could be honestly that I haven't been outside of when I went to the Big Ten opening weekend in Greenville, but that's a minor league park. So it has kind of a different feel to it. Maybe it's that I haven't been in a stadium that big this season. Cause I'm trying to think of like other stadiums I've been in. It's like, you know, Boshimer at UNC is pretty big, but it's not quite that big in terms of like having seating all the way around. Anyway, I don't know, but it just felt a little bit high to me. It was like, it's not a complaint, it's just an observation. My other thing is, quickly, which of the two South Carolina musical cues is your favorite? 2001, A Space Odyssey, or Sandstorm?
I feel like I like Cocky's Dance to Space Odyssey more. It's been a couple of years since I've been in Founders Park, but I feel like that's Cocky's better dance. So I will go with 2001 Space Odyssey.
That's a fair answer and a good way to look at it. We did not get a Cocky appearance this weekend, so I can't speak to his prowess in that particular way. I associate the 2001 Space Odyssey with like Ric Flair, the wrestler, because that was his entrance music in his career. Maybe that's part of why I have a stronger word association with that. The thing about Sandstorm is like, the first couple of times you hear it, you're like, you know, it's a very South Carolina thing that's very ingrained there. So like the first couple of times you hear it, you're like, this is pretty cool. And then times like 5 through 500, you're kind of like a little sick of it. But then at time 501, it comes back around. So that's the thing about Sandstorm. I'll also say they remix Sandstorm now. They've got like a little remix that goes with it. And that was pretty good. I like the remix version a lot, which I know makes me sound like 100 years old saying like, I like that remix version, but I did. I thought it was pretty cool. So regardless, not a super great weekend on the field for South Carolina. Although, you know, they did get the one win, and I guess I don't want to downplay that too much because ultimately, you know, this was a series they were supposed to lose, even with it being at home against the top team in the country. And they did get a win out of it. But I think the reason why I think of it that way, it not being a great weekend for them, is it was very clear that Arkansas was just the better team in just about every phase. And the place you might have thought South Carolina could come into the weekend with a little bit of advantage is look, you know, South Carolina has a very set rotation at this point, and if they can get a little more length from their starting pitchers, and maybe they can, you know, they can really just use it. They're the top bullpen guys they want to use in the specific spots they want to use them. And if they can stay on schedule, maybe they'll be in a good place. The thing about it is that Arkansas kind of played that game this weekend and just beat them at it. You know, it was even in the second game, you know, Peyton Paulette got, you know, hit a little bit as his outing went on there, but he was really pretty good. But Patrick Wicklander was excellent in the final game. And then in the first game, Arkansas played, you know, its pitching game where it wants to split up the innings evenly among three or four different pitchers to absolute perfection. So really the advantage that the perceived advantage that South Carolina had in that, hey, maybe Thomas Farr, you know, turns in one of his better outings this season. And oh, by the way, he did, and it wasn't enough. And then, you know, you get something similar from Brandon Jordan and Will Sanders, and that they just didn't. They didn't get that the rest of the weekend, and that ended up kind of being, you know, a difference there. Even as South Carolina won that middle game, it was a good start for Brandon Jordan, but it wasn't, you know, wasn't his best by any stretch of the imagination. But they did a pretty good job holding down Arkansas's offense. It wasn't a super explosive weekend for Arkansas, but Arkansas clearly was the team swinging the bats better right now. They were getting the big hits. They were coming through in the clutch, whether it was Robert Moore's home runs, you know, they extended at bats. On the contrary, South Carolina's offense is just really scuffling right now. Outside of, they had two multi-run innings in the game they won, but outside of those two outbursts, that was really it. They had two hits in the first and the third game of the series, and that's just not going to be enough to do it. And their stars are really kind of hurting right now. You know, Wes Clark.
And they're a star-powered offense.
Indeed.
Really.
Indeed.
Like, they need Eister and Clark and Allen to drive them, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. They're, you know, unlike Arkansas, right, where, like, you get to the bottom of the Arkansas offense and, like, you know, you might be able to, you know, pitch a little bit to the bottom part of the offense, but Casey Opitz is still a guy who's going to come up with big hits. You know, Jacob Nesbitt is a guy who's going to come up with big hits. For that matter, Robert Moore technically hits in the second half of that lineup there, and we know what he's capable of. So they really can beat you 1 through 9. South Carolina really needs to beat you in the middle of that order, and Wes Clark goes 1 for 11 with 6 strikeouts. And, you know, they weren't good strikeouts to the extent that there's such a thing. Like, it was a lot of kind of quick strikeouts. And there were times where I would look at my computer to type something up and I would look up and somebody had struck out, you know, and just the amount of time it took me to do that. So it's a lineup that's really, really scuffling. And I thought it was instructive that after I read in the State, shout out to Greg Hadley, South Carolina beat writer for the State, he wrote in his piece wrapping up the series that Brady Allen in post game, I presume after the doubleheader, had said that part of the issue is that hitters are going up to the plate right now, kind of looking to react as opposed to kind of going up there with plans. And I thought that was pretty clear in the 5 innings when they faced Kevin Copps. And look, you can have a perfectly good plan against Kevin Copps, and if his stuff is good, there's not a lot you're going to be able to do about it. And that was the case this weekend. He strikes out 12 of the 15 batters he faces in a total of 5 perfect innings. But, you know, I told you over Slack, and I told, you know, I was talking in the press box to some of the other folks that were there. There were a lot of swings and misses on that Kevin Copps cutter that looked like swings and misses that were expecting four seamers. Like, they just didn't look like they had a real clear idea of what they were trying to do against Kevin Copps, which was all the more damning when you consider that Kevin Copps, all he was doing was throwing cutters at them. And so it just, those were really ugly innings. And it just struck me as like being the perfect embodiment of an offense that right now is just completely stuck in neutral.
I've said plenty about Arkansas, and we'll talk a little bit more about the Hogs here in a second. But South Carolina, I just don't have a read for them. They've played, I would say now, 4 premium weekends. If you want to extend it to Clemson, just because of what that rivalry means, I suppose we could extend it to 5, but let's keep it to the, or Georgia. You know, Georgia is now in the top 25. We have a new top 25 of Baseball America, ranked a whole bunch of new teams this week. Check that out. You know, but if you look at it, they went to Texas, they went to Vanderbilt. They got Florida and now Arkansas at home. They have won five of those games. They're 5-7. They got that big sweep of Florida, and that's really carrying them to that 5-7 record. Otherwise, they just haven't really looked good. They did not look good at Texas. I watched a lot of that series. Nothing about that weekend went their way. I mean, that's how you wind up getting swept, but nothing looked good. They looked very bad the first 2 days against Vanderbilt. That's Jack Leiter's no-hitter. Credit to South Carolina for rallying and winning the third game on Sunday at a time when Vanderbilt was really scuffling on Sundays, but, you know, still credit for getting off the mat and doing that on the road. But I mean, they've just looked bad against the best teams on their schedule, I would say. And like, you can say like, well, they did sweep Florida, but you know, Florida's also clearly not at the level of Texas, Vanderbilt, and Arkansas. And look, that nobody is right now. Those are the top three teams in the country. But it also seems very clear, and we can get to this with Mississippi State here in a second as well, that South Carolina is not ready to compete with those teams. They are not, at this point, a national title contender. That doesn't mean they can't win a regional. It doesn't even mean that they couldn't win a super regional. But it does mean that I don't see how that they could go to Omaha and show up and expect to compete for the national title there.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you're seeing some of that. I think in the way the team talks about itself, and even the way Coach Kingston talks about this team, is that maybe expectations outside of the program have maybe outpaced where even the expectations inside the program.
Well, that would be a first time in COLA. I've never heard of that happening down there before.
But I also found out this weekend, by the way, that Soda City, I was not aware Columbia called the Soda City.
Yeah, it's because they call it COLA.
Right. I thought that was kind of a neat little, as someone who drinks far too much Diet Mountain Dew, I appreciated the Soda City. But, you know, some of the quotes in the post game, you know, after the weekend were things talking about, you know, we're a good team, not a great team, which was said was not a definitive statement on how good they are, but just basically that they're in the process of trying to become a great team. And Mark Kingston kind of echoed that. He kept this, you know, he talked about a couple of times that this is, you know, kind of the part of our process to become what we want to become. And so it, you know, seems to suggest that, you know, they realize that like, this is, you know, this is not their final form. If there is a final form to be had, and whether that final form comes, they're running out of time this season, but whether that final form comes this season or in the future of the program as they continue to build. But it does seem a little bit like, you know, maybe that being a top 10 team on a few different occasions as time has gone on this season has maybe made expectations outpace what the reality for the team was. And, you know, that's easy to do. It's easy to get excited when it's like, well, Wes Clark is maybe the best power hitter in college baseball, and he can still finish strong and still end up being in that discussion. And Thomas Farr early in the season was, you know, shoving the baseball, and he and Brandon Jordan looked like a 1-2 punch that was going to be one of the better ones in the SEC. And so far they, to this point now, they've been, to use that phrase again, good, but not great in a lot of cases. So, I think you're exactly right. It's a good team. It's a team that is very capable of a deep postseason run. But if you're talking about national title contenders, they're just not quite there.
I mean, there is something to be said. You got to walk before you can run. We talked about this last week with Tennessee, Tony Vitello talking about how just playing that series against Vanderbilt with so much hype around it would be helpful to them going forward. There's South Carolina, I'm sure, has learned a lot by playing Texas, Vanderbilt, and Arkansas now. But it also, you know, I do wonder though, you're talking about, you know, maybe it's not going to happen for them this year. And I'm here to suggest that as well. But I also kind of worry about like, well, they're going to lose an awful lot off of this team probably. And like, there are still players that are going to return and are going to have the experience and all the rest of it. But you know, you think about some of the players that you figure will leave or have to leave because they're seniors, you know, Clark, Allen, Eister, Farr, Jordan. There are a few other kind of more role players that are going to end up leaving as well, I'm sure. And I mean, wow, that's all of a sudden, like that's a pretty significant core leaving. And I'm not saying South Carolina is going to take a big step back next year or anything like that. I mean, Will Sanders is showing that he can really pitch. And, you know, if that's your Friday night starter in a year, like that's a pretty good place to start. And, you know, who knows what Julian Bosnick will do, or, you know, any number of other players that they've recruited really well over the last couple of years and have another strong class coming in. So I do think that, you know, this year it is a year to, you know, go out and do something, but it does seem like even this year's team has a bit of a cap on it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think it's a safe way to put it. I found fascinating. I'm curious your thoughts. I found fascinating for Arkansas. This is such an interesting team. You know, I'm endlessly fascinated by it. It's been a journey with their pitching. I came into the season like you did, just kind of dubious of like, yeah, you've got a lot of talented pitchers, and you know, Dave Van Horn raved in the preseason about having never had this kind of talented depth on the mound. And you and I still kind of looked askance at it and said, well, yeah, but who are your starters? And then we come into this season and that's still a valid question, but all of a sudden it's like, okay, but here's the depth. So we understand they're just going to do it differently. And they still continue to do so. I wrote about it after the game Thursday. Like, their Thursday win is a great example of like, we only got 3 1/3 innings out of our starter, but so what? You know, we still controlled that game. We still were calling the shots we wanted to call. But then the second half of the weekend, you get a pretty good start from Peyton Paulette. And at this point, you know, he kind of is what he is, where, you know, he really hasn't had the deep, deep starts, but, you know, he gives you 5 or 6 every weekend that are pretty good. And then Wicklander comes out and does something that he's had some nice moments this season, but this is, I think, the best start he's had this season, where it's, you know, 7 really strong innings and was just in the rocking chair from beginning to end. And perhaps he was a pitcher perfectly suited to pitch well against this South Carolina offense that's struggling right now, because I'm here to tell you, it was a lot of like, here's a fastball over the plate and a first pitch swing, and it's popped up to first base. There was a lot of that. So I'm not out here saying that Patrick Wicklander was dominating, but I am fascinated by the idea now that, like, it seems kind of unfair that like Arkansas is now in a position where it's like, maybe they do with Paulette and Wicklander have a couple guys they can depend on to a certain degree. And on top of that, if they don't have that in a given weekend, like, we'll throw the bullpen game at you. And I've said before this season, and I said on radio in Columbia, South Carolina, I was on the radio locally there on Thursday, that, you know, the one place you can get Arkansas
flex.
Is because they're, well, yeah, it's just a little humble brag there. But the place you can get Arkansas a little bit is like, they don't get those types of starts. So if you can really land a knockout blow in the first inning, for example, and have a guy pitch 2/3 of the inning, you maybe can tax their bullpen to the point where even a good bullpen like that is going to be spent by the end of the weekend. And I'm less convinced of that now, given what we saw from the starters over the weekend.
Yeah. I wouldn't have gone there the way you did. I mean, I guess I've been a little less, I was faster to accept Arkansas for who their pitching staff is than you were this year. And, you know, I just think that, you know, it does change the game a little bit if Wicklander is going to start going 7. I don't know how regular that's going to be. You know, as you mentioned, coming into this series, they were in a kind of difficult spot, just having to play 6 SEC games in 6 days, 7 days, whatever it was, because of the rainouts they'd gone through, and, you know, throwing double headers into all of that. And, you know, I just think that they've got some really good pitchers that can do a variety of things. Like Wicklander and Paulette and Vermillion and Bolden have all had success in a variety of roles. Copps is maybe the best reliever in the country, and they got plenty of other guys that they trust coming out of the bullpen. It doesn't just have to be the Kevin Copps show. This isn't like Ole Miss, where if Broadway doesn't get it done, you're looking around like, okay, well, who is it then? Like, okay, if Copps isn't available because he threw a bunch yesterday, like, that's fine, we got other guys. And, you know, so I guess it is interesting that Wicklander showed that he could do 7, but I mean, at the same time, like, I knew that was in there because we'd seen that in previous years. He just hadn't been asked to do it this year. And The endlessly fascinating thing to me about Arkansas is that they can play whatever game you want to play. Like you said, like this went more to South Carolina's script. They just beat South Carolina at their own game. They do that to teams. It doesn't matter how you want to play a game. Like they can play it with you and they'll probably beat you doing it.
Yeah. And there was little, I mean, like I said, it in some ways it feels like a sweep. And I think part of that is because Arkansas had a standalone moment on Thursday. And then in the doubleheader, like doubleheaders are just always weird whenever they split, and they often split, you know, because South Carolina wins a game and feels pretty good about itself and then comes right back out a couple hours later and loses again. And so it does feel a little bit strange in that way. That's probably part of why it feels like a sweep, but it was also just that, you know, South Carolina's rally in game two turned up, you know, a 2-0 Arkansas lead into a South Carolina lead and then a victory within a matter of, I don't know, half an hour, 45 minutes, and then they were right back out and losing again. So there wasn't a lot of time where it felt like South Carolina was really in control this weekend. And it was just, could not have been any clearer at this point that Arkansas was just in all phases was just better. And they're more ready to win like this than South Carolina is.
All right. Well, we've got another top 10 SEC series to talk about, and we'll get to that here in a second. But first, check this out.
Gary bought a trampoline online with Visa, so he has protection if his card is used fraudulently. Now Gary's feeling pretty confident. Confident enough to try a slam dunk from his trampoline. Oh, Gary. Visa's zero liability helps protect you from fraud. We just can't protect you from yourself. Search Visa How You Pay Matters to find out more. Commercial and anonymous prepaid cards excluded. Responsible card use required. Contact your bank for T&Cs.
Okay, Joe, the other top 10 SEC series was Vanderbilt hosting Mississippi State. This was a very intriguing matchup, both on and off the field. We mentioned before, these are two fan bases that don't really like each other. That'll happen when, in the last two NCAA tournaments, one of these teams ended the other's season. And, you know, it played out in a pretty interesting fashion on Friday night. Kamar Rocker threw a complete game, his first CG of the year. He was in control all game long, beats Mississippi State. Then on Saturday, Mississippi State bounces back, gets to Leiter, beats Leiter, evens the series. And then on Sunday, the Bulldogs jump out to an early 4-0 lead. And, you know, it would be understandable if anybody thought, like, okay, like, here goes Vanderbilt on game three of an SEC series again. Like, is this gonna go their way? Like, it doesn't look great, but they stopped the bleeding and they scored the next 7 runs and they won the game 7-4. And honestly, the game at the end didn't even feel like it was a save situation, I guess, at the end, but it didn't feel like that. It didn't feel that close. And Vanderbilt comes away with another high-end series win. And you know, it seems like Vanderbilt is getting to a point where they understand how they need to win games. They're not a finished product, but even when they don't get to stick to a more typical script, you know, we're talking about how Arkansas wins playing your game. Well, Vanderbilt probably still needs to stick to their script a little bit, but they are learning how to do a little bit more. And, you know, the offense continues to be really impressive. They're finding some guys to step up in the bullpen. And so even if they don't win both of Rocker and Leiter starts, as they haven't for the last 3 straight weeks now, they still have won 2 out of those 3 series. And the 2 series they won are against Tennessee and Mississippi State, who are both, you know, legitimate top 10 teams, legitimate Omaha type teams. And I think that just said a lot that they were able to get that done over the last 2 weeks.
I think it's one of the things that stands out about Vanderbilt in this situation is that they're a team that they have this, you know, weakness is maybe strong, but this soft spot on Sundays where they're certainly not as confident in what they have on the mound as they are the first 2 days of the weekend. But they're still a team that on those days, they can have that off day and you still have to come out and play well to beat them. You know, we talk about the weakness on Sundays, but not a lot of teams have been able to do that. That's something that teams have been able to take advantage of them a little bit, but Vanderbilt mostly finds a way. They mostly get it done, and in this case, it was, you know, the offense, you know, getting to Mississippi State pitching in the middle innings and getting some outstanding relief work. So there are certain teams that if you kind of knock them off their bearings and you're able to take advantage of their weaknesses, they don't really have like a next gear. They don't really have like the zig when they started off zagging. Vanderbilt does, like, and that's what makes them obviously the number two team in the country for a reason. But that's a big part of that is that, you know, okay, you know, we're going to get a third of an inning on Sunday and we're still going to find a way to come back and win that game and then clinch the series when there are a lot of other teams that just wouldn't have, you know, there are a lot of teams we've talked about being flawed that just don't have a way to kind of come back and fight that in that situation. And Vanderbilt just continues to do so.
Yeah. I mean, you get punched in the mouth like that, it's hard for any team to fight back, but especially I think a little bit of a younger and inexperienced team like Vanderbilt still is. And just ask Tim Corbin, he'll tell you, but you know, they don't have, you know, they're playing a lot of freshmen and sophomores, and even the more experienced guys weren't guys, you know, in 2019, really, with the exception of Rocker, and he's not helping the offense figure it out on a Sunday. I don't think. I know that he's a good teammate, and you know, you see him cheering in the dugout and stuff, but I don't think he's breaking down swings for them on Sunday and helping the offense find a way against the Mississippi State bullpen. But yeah, it's hard not to come away with what Vanderbilt's done over the last 2 weeks, very impressed. We can talk about this more in a second, and we will, but you know, it sure looks like now, like when we're going to talk about national championship contenders in this season, it's Arkansas and Vanderbilt, and then it's everyone else. And you know, this weekend definitely hammered that home. And you know, like South Carolina, we're talking about having played Texas, Vanderbilt and Arkansas and having lost all three of those series, going 2-7 in that stretch. Mississippi State has now played both Arkansas and Vanderbilt and gone 1-5. They also played Texas. They won that game. So they're 2-5 against those three teams. And it just seems like something is missing for the Bulldogs in those big moments. I don't know if it's the defense. I don't know if it's just that they're a couple arms short to compete with them. I don't know if you have ideas on what it might be, Joe, but it just seems like this Mississippi State team is missing something. And it may just be, again, that they just can't match talent for talent with Arkansas and Vanderbilt. But, you know, they're 1-5. They're clearly not on their level right now. And frankly, I don't see anything that would suggest they're going to find a way to get to that level over the next 6 weeks.
Yeah, so I don't really necessarily feel qualified to like give an official diagnosis on this, but I would posit this maybe as like a thought exercise. So when they've had a lot of success, like when we talked about winning the series against Ole Miss, and there was a series before we talked about them, I forget, but one of the things that kept coming up is the idea that Mississippi State does a pretty good job, and this is still true, I think, you know, against teams that they can handle, where they can match talent for talent, they do a pretty good job of just kind of winning the game the way they need to win it. And if that's, look, we're going to have to get a ton of innings from our bullpen, they can kind of do that. If they seem to be very, very good at coming up with the big hits in the right moments. There seems to be, to the extent that something exists, they do seem to be a relatively clutch team offensively. But I think the flip side of that is that I think part of the reason why, at least I can only speak for myself, part of the reason why I kind of go back to that position and thinking that way about Mississippi State is I'm also not exactly sure what they hang their hat on, right? Like,
it's supposed to be their pitching.
It is.
That's what it's supposed to be. But like, if you look at what their starters have done recently, like, it's really then, yeah, it's not great. Their bullpen, yeah. I guess.
And I just think it's hard. So like, I think that's right. And but then like outside of Lane and Sims, like it does feel like there's at least one or two instances every weekend where they just don't get what they need from a bullpen guy. Like this weekend, you know, Houston Harding was an example where he comes in to stop the bleeding and can't. And I don't mean to pick on him. That's just the example sitting in front of me. So like, I also just think it's hard, like, unless you're Arkansas good in the bullpen, like, I think it's just hard for that to be what you're hanging your hat on and that to be enough, like your bullpen, right? Like, that's just, I think that's of all the different phases, like that is a hard thing to be able to really hang your hat on and be national title good. But so again, I don't feel qualified to really give like an official diagnosis on this, you know, not watching, you know, all 27 innings every weekend, but I do wonder if it's just simply like the kind of things they hang their hat on just aren't enough to be difference makers, because with everything else, they're, you know, that they're a solid team, but I'm not sure where the standouts are.
Yeah. I mean, their lineup has some really good core pieces. Rowdy Jordan played really well this weekend. He's continuing to be hot. You know, Tim Corbin after the series mentioned the fact that Jordan and Allen, who are clearly Mississippi State's best hitters, like they've been through this. You're not going to scare them. They've been to Omaha. They've done everything you could want to do as college baseball players. Nothing's going to intimidate them, and they're going to be ready to hit. And that's what they do most of the time. But you know, the same can't necessarily be said for the rest of that lineup. The starting pitching over the last few weeks hasn't been as good as it had been previously. You know, this was supposed to be a pitching staff that had perhaps the best rotation in the country. That just has not materialized in that way. The bullpen is one of the better bullpens. If Kevin Copps isn't the best reliever in the country, it might be Landon Sims. But yeah, I mean, to your point, like, first of all, is that enough to, even if it were the best bullpen in the country, is it enough to make that your thing? And then B, is it actually the best bullpen in the country? And they're a fine defensive team, but not an elite defensive team. And, you know, so I think, yeah, ultimately it's a really good team, but when you're trying to compete against the superpowers of Arkansas and Vanderbilt, you can see how they would fall short. And, you know, if you want to see that further, I mean, they played six games against those two teams. So, you know, go and watch any of those games, and you know it will become relatively apparent, I think, as to why that has happened. And we've talked a lot about Vanderbilt here. I don't know how much left there is to say given how much we've talked about them over the last couple of weeks, Joe. But is there anything that stood out for you this weekend for them? You know, whether that's Rocker being efficient enough to go nine. Whether that's what McElvin did out of the bullpen on Sunday, or, you know, any number of their hitters who have, CJ Rodriguez continues to impress me. Was there anything that Vanderbilt did that really was a standout for you this weekend?
Yeah, I think a couple things quickly. One is that Rocker really seeming to kind of put to rest all of the worries that there were 2-3 weeks ago about something that might be going on with him. Like, it's clear that was just, you know, that's just life. Like, you're going to have bad starts. So I think he has kind of fully put that in the rearview mirror. The work of McElvain and Maldonado on Sunday was incredible. And that's stuff like that's going to be a huge piece of this Vanderbilt team, as long as they're not sure who their third guy is. And, you know, look, you know, as well as I do, you go into the postseason, and as much as we talk about, well, in the regular season, like, not that many teams actually have a third guy they trust. In the postseason, unless you get behind schedule in a regional and get into the loser's bracket, third guy arguably becomes even less important in those situations. So that's, you know, I think that's a big development, because I think they're going to need those types of bullpen guys that they know they can turn to for outings like that. One thing I would say on the other side of the spectrum is that, you know, this is the second straight start where Jack Leiter's gotten hit a little bit, and we're of course grading on a curve here where his, where he was at before was so high that he was inevitably going to disappoint at some point, because no one can keep that up, what he was doing for an entire season, especially in the SEC. But it is worth noting, and it is worth watching, that, you know, he's in a territory now where he's never thrown this much. And let me be very clear, because some people might be hearing me that, like, you know, it could be like an injurious thing for him. I don't mean that at all. I just mean the body. You know, it's at a point now where he's got more innings and is throwing more pitches than he has before and against elite level competition. And so, you know, at this time of year, you start to wonder about things like, you know, him bouncing back and him being a sharp when he bounces back and maybe being a little more inconsistent as the season goes on. And when you combine that with the book being a little more out on him, that is something to watch moving forward, because, you know, he is still a freshman, technically speaking, even if that doesn't really matter because he's going to leave for the draft before he exhausts eligibility, yada, yada, yada. But that is something to watch moving forward, is how does he continue to respond as these innings start to pile up for him?
To me, more than that, and not to belittle the importance of the potential freshman wall and all the rest of that, because that is that's a potential thing as well. But I would want to dig into this, and maybe I need to dig into this, or at least ask some people who have really looked at Leiter over the last couple of weeks. Are teams approaching him differently? Because there's a lot more video on him now, and, you know, SEC teams are very well equipped to find and exploit anything, any little thing that they find. Is that what is happening? Is that, you know, Tennessee and Mississippi State were able to find something and make an adjustment, and now Leiter has to adjust back, and can he? Like, if that's what's happening, you know, that's something that happens in baseball all the time. And, you know, now it's going to be on him to find something. Or, you know, maybe it's just, look, he was pitching otherworldly and now he's merely pitching really, really well, you know, or maybe not really, really well, just he's pitching okay. You know, that's going to happen too at times in life. But how he reacts to this down the stretch is going to be important, because, you know, Vanderbilt needs him to pitch at a pretty high level to reach their ceiling. And now, speaking of ceilings, Joe, I came to the conclusion this weekend that for the national championship, like I said, it's Arkansas, it's Vanderbilt, and then it's everyone else. So, Joe, are you taking Arkansas or Vanderbilt or the field right now?
So I have to choose one of Arkansas, Vanderbilt, or the field?
That's correct. You do not get both the Hogs and the Doors.
I'll still take the field. The field just seems like the smart play, especially when you get into Omaha, because, like, I think about it this way, is like any one person can have a bad day, and, you know, you're one bad start from being in a loser's bracket, and it's just really tough when you get to Omaha and all the teams are good to come back from that. So I'll still take the field, but man, if you'd have packaged the two together, I'd probably go that direction.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely go that direction if I packaged the two together. But I'll go with the Hogs just as is. On their own, I'm willing to take them. You know, when you evaluate the field, like, you do get 291 teams. So there's definitely something to be said for that. And like you're saying, you know, like, bad days happen. You know, we still have 5 weeks of, or five weeks of baseball before the NCAA tournament. Like, who knows what can happen in that? You know, teams go up, teams go down, injuries, players get healthy, whatever. But you start looking at the teams that are in the field, that are contenders, that aren't Arkansas and Vanderbilt. And, you know, we just broke down why Mississippi State isn't beating Arkansas and Vanderbilt right now. You know, Texas would be interesting. Very interested to see them play TCU in 2 weeks. They're playing at a really high level. You know, but their offense is still not all that great. Like, it's a good offense, it's not a great offense. Is that going to hold them back eventually? We really like Louisville, but Louisville hasn't been healthy all year long. I want to see a fully healthy Louisville. Maybe they will be by the NCAA tournament, but you know, it also seems like what we've seen to this point is that their pitching isn't what it traditionally is, and that's not going to be good enough, I don't think. Again, maybe fully healthy Louisville is a little bit different, but that's asking a lot at this point. You know, and you can keep going down the line. You know, Notre Dame, ECU, they've never done it. You know, none of these players has ever done it. And frankly, their coaching staffs don't even have a whole lot of Omaha experience there. So, you know, first timers have been successful look at Coastal, look at Michigan, which I know as a program wasn't a first timer, but for those players, it was their first time, you know, playing deep into the NCAA tournament. And, you know, so it's happened recently for those teams, but typically it's really hard for teams that haven't been to Omaha to, you know, come out and have success against the more experienced groups. And, you know, I mean, I can play this game, and I did, in off the bat for, you know, just about anyone else in the country. And it's just hard to see who it would be. Now, again, they got 6-7 weeks to figure this out before they get to Omaha. But, you know, right now, it just feels hard for me to imagine any team taking down both Vanderbilt and Arkansas, which is probably what they're going to have to do to win a national title. Alrighty, Joe, let's get out of the SEC. We've talked a lot about it to this point, and let's go to the Big 12. And, you know, the I've cited this several times, Texas Tech, just a different team in Lubbock, that they hadn't lost a weekend series to in Lubbock since 2018. And that streak came to an end this weekend at the hands of Baylor. And it was a stunning way that it happened. Not only that it was Baylor, which came into the weekend under 500 in Big 12 play, still is under 500 in Big 12 play. I mean, they're the fifth best team in the Big 12 at worst, but they are, you know, they weren't, you know, one of those teams that looked like they were contending for the Big 12 and still aren't. They got two blowout wins at Texas Tech. Now, this is a beat up Texas Tech team. They lost a couple really good players for the rest of the season. But this was still, I thought, a rather stunning development that the Bears were able to go into Lubbock and really have their way on Friday and Sunday.
Yes, absolutely stunning. You know, one game is one thing. Like, those game types of games just happen. But to come back and do that again on Sunday, incredibly impressive. And really, not that far from being a Baylor sweep. You know, Texas Tech with a late comeback, Braxton Fulford, a bases-loaded double to score three runs and hand them the win on Saturday, kind of saved that there. But, yeah, just a really impressive weekend for Baylor and big for, obviously, Baylor's postseason hopes. This was a team that went 1-5 against Texas and TCU, and had they lost this series, there was still a path to the postseason because they're – schedule the rest of the way is pretty manageable is Baylor's, but they would have had to do some pretty heavy lifting to get there. I think this really,
it would have been very bubbly, even if they'd done the lifting you're describing. It would have been like probably bubble in, but like, yeah, we're going to sweat this maybe a little bit if we don't play well in the Big 12 tournament.
Yeah. Like classic bubble in, like borderline 2-3 seed that, you know, you don't know much about, and they just kind of got in, you know, the classic profile of beat all the teams you should, lost all the teams that were better than you, and that's good enough in a major conference. Like, we see those teams every year. So that was exactly the track they were on. And now they've, you know, that's still largely the path, but this certainly changed the math a little bit for Baylor. So a big series there for the, and big for the conference, because for a while it was kind of looking like, you know, it's four teams probably, and then like that might be it. And now this kind of opens the door for there to be a fifth there. It's a Baylor team that I feel like you know, last night you and I were talking and I said, you know, this lineup is like full of guys I've never really heard of. And then I kind of went and looked at it a little bit closer. And I guess I kind of undersold that there is still some DNA here from, you know, some of these Baylor teams that have been good in recent years with Andy Thomas and Davion Downey and Chase Wesener and guys like that. And Jared McKenzie's a really good talent. And so you combine that with some younger players who are pretty exciting, guys like Trey Richardson, Kyle Nevin, guys like that. And so I was probably underselling it a little bit in terms of just the fact that it's a good mix of kind of some younger, more exciting players and some guys who have just kind of been through battles with this program. It's a pretty good offense overall. Like, their numbers overall they're hitting about 300 as a team. In conference, obviously, it's not quite that, but that's the way it works in major conferences. And the part that seems a little more, I don't want to say smoke and mirrors, because that suggests that getting away with something here, but it's unique in college baseball. And this is not a strikeout staff. Like, this is not an overpowering pitching staff, but they did a really good job against Texas Tech. You know, they got, you know, the innings they needed out of their starters. They were able to piece it together in the bullpen, and they just kind of did enough on the mound. And that would be the area where I think, you know, you, I think if you come into a series with Baylor, you feel like you can do some things against that pitching staff, especially once you get past Tyler Thomas on Friday, who's a really good arm. And I think that's kind of what I expected here with Texas Tech, but then you get to Saturday and, you know, Tech didn't really break through until late in the game. And then you get to Sunday and they were stifled from the very beginning and really didn't get going until, you know, it was too late essentially. So it was just surprising in just about every way, not only when you consider how well Texas Tech plays at home, but also that this particular Baylor team, I would not have guessed would have been the type of team that was built to go into Lubbock and get it done. I, you know, there are several other teams in the Big 12 who are lesser teams than Baylor, who I thought maybe, or at least similar teams to Baylor in terms of wins and losses, that I thought would be better equipped to get this done. But it was Baylor that did it.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that, you know, we saw TCU not be able to do this just a couple weeks ago, and then Baylor turns around and does it is very surprising. And, you know, Tech had gone to Morgantown a week ago and gotten a tough series win against West Virginia. After hearing all the news about that injury stuff, just having dealt with it. And, you know, I thought like, okay, well, maybe, you know, it's clearly a big deal and it's going to affect them at some point, but, you know, maybe it doesn't have to change their outlook in the Big 12. Maybe they can still compete for the Big 12 title. But, you know, really after, if you combine this result and what happened in Stillwater with Texas beating Oklahoma State, any thoughts of any team other than Texas or TCU winning the Big 12, I think are over. And, you know, Tech has that trip to Austin this weekend. You know, the Red Raiders are still in a position to host a regional, but this weekend just became a lot bigger from that aspect. They could really, really use something to offset this series loss in Austin if they're going to get that regional in Lubbock again this year. And this, again, combine these two results, and in 2 weeks, Texas goes to Fort Worth. And no matter what happens this weekend, you know, even if UT loses that series in Austin, that is a massive showdown. It's going to be for the Big 12 title in Lupton in a couple of weeks. So, I mean, we'll get into that plenty then. You know, but impressive weekend for Baylor, and, you know, a good showing for UT up in Stillwater as well. We'd mentioned before that they'd played a softer Big 12 schedule than some of the other contenders. That kind of changed this weekend, having to go up to Stillwater and them coming away with a big doubleheader sweep on Saturday to clinch the series.
Yeah, it's certainly. I mean, you're right. Like, we're looking at a two horse race here, and you know, that series is, I think, going to, it was looking like it might be a little bit of like a gauntlet situation, you know, with Texas, but obviously Texas Tech having lost the series coming into the weekend takes a little bit of the juice out of that. But still, we're looking ahead to that series, and it would be, you know, a very Texas Tech thing, I think, to give the Longhorns all they can handle and challenge to win that series.
I would agree with that. We'll probably break that down on the Thursday podcast as we preview what looks to be a bit of a lighter college baseball slate coming up this weekend, but you know, we'll see. We'll still get excited about these series. We don't have a top 10 series this week, and Baylor beating Texas Tech is a big part of the reason why. all right, Joe, let's swing over to the ACC. As always this season, the ACC provided any number of things for us to talk about. None of them at this point of the season, I didn't think, were overly you know, stunning or massively changing anyone's season, I don't think, but still, the most significant result, I think, was probably NC State sweeping Virginia Tech in Raleigh. That puts NC State really back on track to make the NCAA tournament, which is really significant. They had not looked like they were on that track for the first couple months of the season, I guess. They dealt with some COVID issues, some off the field issues, but NC State seems like they're rounding into form here at the right time. So that's really big. Clemson got a needed sweep of Wake Forest to keep its own NCAA tournament hopes alive. Florida State went into Atlanta, won a series against Georgia Tech. in what may have ended up being the series of the weekend from on a paper standpoint after Louisville and Pitt got canceled. That, frankly, may have been the most significant thing that happened because Louisville misses out on an opportunity to improve its RPI against Pitt, and Pitt misses out on an opportunity to, you know, add something marquee to its hosting resume. And then the other ACC series, UNC gets a nice series win against Miami, and Notre Dame continues to remain undefeated in series this season because they scored 12 runs in the eighth inning against BC to come back and win the rubber game on Saturday. I was, full disclosure, they are the Oba Irish. I never don't believe in them, but I was starting to look at like, okay, can I complete the ACC wheel of chaos now if Boston College finishes this out? I didn't get a chance to finish it because Notre Dame finds a way to win yet again, and they are 18-8 in the ACC, and you know, Louisville has a better winning percentage by 0.008 of a percentage point, but Notre Dame still very much on track to host a regional in South Bend.
Yeah, absolutely. And the you know, who is probably particularly excited about Notre Dame hosting a regional is the selection committee, because it will kind of help them in a situation where otherwise they might be looking at maybe reaching for a Big Ten team or finding some other team in the region to send some of these Midwestern and you know, East Coast, mid and low majors to.
You know, so, Wright State has a top 16 RPI, so that's all I'm going to say about
there
that.
It is. I mean, look no further, I would say. So the committee has to be pretty excited about, you know, Notre and Pitt, by the way. If Pitt continues to trend in the right direction, like, they might really, I don't want to say let them off the hook, but they might make the decision kind of easy for the selection committee and not having to reach for anything in particular from a geographic standpoint, if that is something they would do. And we still don't know. We just don't exactly know how they're going to handle this situation. So that is obviously further discussions down the road. I think you're right. I think perhaps the biggest result, maybe I'm being myopic about it because I'm looking at writing about that this week, is NC State getting back up off the mat and sweeping that series against Virginia Tech, which puts them firmly back on the path to being in the postseason, like you said. And it's kind of funny in this season of the ACC having these weird resumes where, you know, Notre Dame and Pitt have earned their resumes, but certainly at the beginning of the season, we would have looked kind of strange at that, that those teams have top 25 RPIs and are leading the divisions and, you know, are on pace to do what the types of things that we're predicting they will do. But then you've got these other resumes like Louisville's that are just really weird, where it's, you know, clearly one of the better teams in the ACC, clearly a team that should be in line to host, but has an RPI that just in a normal year would definitely not get them there. And yet you have NC State, who has like literally the platonic ideal of a bubble team resume, where it's 500 in ACC play and an RPI of 45, like just exactly right where a bubble team normally is. And let me tell you
that RPI of 45 this year, if they can hold it there, that's going to look fantastic.
Monday. By comparison. Yeah. That's like an easy two right there. Yeah. That's just, so they had just had this, they're right on the money in terms of what they need to do. You know, Virginia is kind of, I was kind of tracking both NC State and Virginia because I thought, you know, if both those teams kind of do it, you know, sweep those series, like that might be the story instead of just one of these teams. So Virginia did what it needed to do to win that series against Duke, but man, a sweep would have gotten a lot further in that direction. We've talked before about the path Virginia has to getting back in the postseason, which I think is still somewhat plausible, but
it is tenuous still. Yes, I did forget to mention that Virginia won a series against Duke. They've won, what is it now, three of their last four. And, you know, the one series loss is Louisville. It's a massive series this weekend in Blacksburg for them. I mean, they still close just fine against Wake and BC. So there are probably wins to be had there against the two worst teams in the conference. And I still feel really good about UVA figuring it out and getting in. But this weekend, they have a chance to really take a, you know, further step towards comfortably getting in the tournament, I would say.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's a team that it feels like they need that. Whereas this weekend, NC State you know, just made a big statement with the sweep. Like, that's really kind of what's been missing so far for UVA, is just that sweep that really kind of turns the tide on the record, because that's where you really start making some hay, is when you can get some of those sweeps. And perhaps those are still on the way, but kind of a strange season in the ACC continues. And I wonder, this is a bigger discussion than what we should probably be doing here today, but I do wonder, in some ways, I think Notre Dame and Pitt being these really, in part because of, and then maybe, I'm not sure exactly how to phrase it, but with Notre Dame and Pitt being these really good stories, and to some degree Virginia Tech, I suppose, like, I think has maybe created like a situation where, you know, the ACC, you know, fairly mediocre season in a lot of cases. And the fact that Notre Dame has been so good, and in part of that is probably because the ACC has been relatively mediocre overall, to where a good team like Notre Dame is able to get to the next level by feasting a little bit on it. You know, if Notre Dame and Pitt weren't as good and talented as they are to really take advantage of that, like, I'm not really sure what we'd be looking at with the ACC this year.
That's a good point. I mean, three of the top four teams in the two divisions are Pitt, Virginia Tech, and Notre Dame. And I'm pretty sure Notre Dame's the most recent NCAA tournament team of that group, and that was 2015. It's just been a long time for any of those teams. Pitt, obviously, the longest of any and the least history of any. I mean, you'd be looking at Louisville and just wondering, like, what is going on? And so maybe this is a really good thing for the conference. I do think Louisville and Florida State are pretty legit. I think what Florida State did this weekend in Atlanta was really impressive. They really took it to Georgia Tech in the first two games. And, you know, Georgia Tech's going to be hard to sweep at home. So they won the third game. And that was actually Danny Hall's 1300th victory of his career. And there was a fun celebration video as he was doing his press conference. The Yellow Jackets came and mobbed him, I guess in his office, wherever he does media from. That was pretty cool video that Georgia Tech threw up on Twitter. So they have some good teams here. But yeah, I mean, I think that you're probably onto something, Joe, that Notre Dame and Pitt being the stories that they are is helping to paper over some things in this conference. As we talk, like, I have one of the UNC Miami games from this weekend on TV, and, you know, Miami, after losing this weekend in Chapel Hill, no shame in that, but they're now 14-12 in the conference, 22-13 overall. You consider what happened on opening weekend, how exciting that was, and think about where they could be. Their RPI is the second best in the ACC right now. Only Notre Dame has a better RPI than Miami, but it doesn't really feel like they're in the hosting mix at all, because they're just so far in the middle of the ACC standings. And, you know, you think about what could have been for the Canes if they just avoid a couple of these series losses. And, you know, I think that's kind of emblematic of the conference overall. I mean, UNC has some of the same deal that I'm describing for Miami, just a slightly worse RPI because they didn't get a road series win against an SEC team to open the season.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. Is you can really get down the rabbit hole of looking at teams' resumes and, you know, saying that, you know, well, this, you know, this team's resume is based on this series win against this team, and now we know that team isn't as good as they were. But then you look at that team and you can play the same game, and that's like a totally different wheel for the ACC here, that these resumes all kind of cannibalize each other, which I guess is what happens when you play as many conference games. But you and I have done that game a lot when we start trying to rank teams every week, is that, you know, there's every one of these teams has something about their resume that is somewhat fraudulent because of what we know now. And every team kind of has something that could be used as a trump card against someone else. And, you know, ultimately I think we'll remember this ACC season probably for a number of things, but depending on how these teams do in the postseason, like, that's kind of what it comes down to.
The Omaha Irish going to Omaha.
That's right. They fulfill their destiny. But we do this with conferences all the time. Like, how often do you, when we talk for the millionth time about the plight of the Big West, how often do Big West supporters come back with, well, but, you know, they keep getting teams to Omaha, you know, so that, I mean, that ends up being kind of the right or wrong, the be all end all that people throw around. So how these teams finish in the postseason, I think will have a little bit of bearing on how we remember it.
All right, Joe, let's move on here and let's talk about Fairfield and how to talk to everyone, how to talk to your children about 25-0 Fairfield, number two in the RPI, and now number 23 in the Baseball America Top 25. The Stags are ranked for the first time in program history, in any national publication, as I learned today via Fairfield, not just in the Baseball America poll, but in any national publication. This is their first ranking. Joe, if we're being honest here, and we talk about, you know, Georgia Tech, who we were just talking about, they drop out of the top 25 this week. If we put Georgia Tech and Fairfield on a neutral, I'm probably taking Georgia Tech to win the series. But we've talked all season long about how I wanted to make the BA top 25 a little more resume based. And look, I can no longer deny that Fairfield has one of the 25 best resumes in the country. There's a zero in the loss column. And is the conference that Fairfield plays in particularly good? No, it's not. They are not playing non-conference games. We have nothing to compare them against. It's a completely insular system there. But they've won 25 straight games, and they have not lost this season. And frankly, against any sort of competition, if you're doing that, you know, we gotta pay attention. And this week, that meant that Fairfield moves into the top 25.
And they are just clearly so much better than the rest of the conference. Like I wrote about this in the top 25 capsule. I wrote about it in our roundup on Friday night. Like, they just pick any stat and they're just absolutely dominating the opposition in it. They're just a cut above. And like, I guess that goes without saying, that's the reason they're 25-0. But I think if you're the type of person who's out there and is poo-pooing on Fairfield being in the top 25, first of all, try to have a little fun in your life, honestly, because like that you're taking the top 20. And I don't want to undercut the work we do here. This is truly not what I mean by this, but if you're going to complain about Fairfield being 23rd in the top 25, because they're probably not technically one of the top 20, the best 25 teams in college baseball, like you're taking the top 25 a little too seriously and literally. Like, I think we can sometimes use the top 25 while evaluating resumes and trying to put the best teams in and really spending a lot of time. Anyone who would, if you were able to tap your way into the phone calls Teddy and I have on Sunday night, you would know the kind of care and effort we put into this weekly. However, I think there is room in the top 25 to just kind of celebrate things sometimes. And I don't think I think we're in a position to admit that part of this is just kind of like, look at this team that's undefeated throughout the season, just like you said, and celebrate that by putting them in the top 25, because it is not the 25, but if you were to put together a top 25 of the 25 best teams in college baseball right now, Auburn might be on that list because they're playing well and just kind of keep losing games because the SEC is tough. So like we can't do it that way, you know, so sometimes you have to pull in teams from different places. And I think if we're not going to rank this team that is doing this in this particular year, in a week, by the way, that we had to bring in five new teams, you know, when were we going to do it? So it was just, I think it was the right time to do it. I think it's the right thing to do to celebrate how good this team has been. And I think it's, you know, I understand that the argument that is correct, by the way, that Fairfield is probably not one of the 25 best teams in college baseball, but they also at the same time are right to be in this top 25.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously it's strange that they're not playing non-conference games, because if you look at Jackson State, which is 18-0 in SWAC play, 22-8 overall, I'm sure if you pull up their SWAC numbers, you can view something similar to what's happening to, you know, just how badly they're beating up on other SWAC teams. But they do have an 8 in the loss column. And like, that's not really through any fault of their own. Like, you know, okay, like you lose some non-conference games. It happens. One of those non-conference losses, for instance, is Mississippi State. Like, I just happen to know that happened. Maybe they lost to Ole Miss too. I have no idea. But, you know, Fairfield didn't do that for reasons, like, not through, it's not their choice that they're only playing conference games. I'm sure they would love to be playing non-conference games, but you know, again, it's a zero in the loss column after 25 games. Like I think we just kind of have to respect that. And I mean, I keep talking about the zero, and you might say, well, what if there was only a one there? What if they were 24-1? Would they be ranked? Like, I don't know. I don't know. I don't have to think about that though, because they went out and they won 25 straight games, and it's impressive. And so they're into the top 25. And congrats to the Stags. I have literally no idea what the committee is going to do to them or do with them. I'm sure they won't post. I don't even know if Fairfield submitted a bid. I'm not gonna follow up on that either. I don't think, because they're not hosting. I cannot imagine a situation where that happens. Can they be a two seed? I don't know. Bryant was a two seed a couple of years ago with some ridiculous record, but Bryant also had played non-conference games. So I don't know. It's uncharted territories, uncharted waters here. But I do think that we're not looking at a four seed with Fairfield. I think that, assuming this continues and that they go on and win the auto bid, because that's going to be probably a requirement here. I'm not saying they have to stay undefeated, but if they just avoid more than a couple losses, like they can probably be a three seed. And if they went into it undefeated, like why not a two? We'll see.
Yep. There's definitely been, I mean, you mentioned Bryant, you know, I think that year they're, well, I was going to reference their RPI, but obviously Fairfield has that going in their favor too. But you know, they
which is a different discussion. Like, look, it's an insular system. RPI does not work. I cannot stress this enough. If you don't play any other teams outside of your conference, outside of your ecosystem, and no teams in your conference play outside of that ecosystem, RPI does not work. What Fairfield is the top RPI team in the MAAC. Are they the number two RPI team in the country? Yes, because RPI is too dumb to acknowledge what is happening here, but they shouldn't be. Anyway, continue.
They tricked the computers.
They did. They literally did. This is a true computer trickery.
Yeah. But I think Southern with Ricky Weeks, I think, was a two way back then. So that's another example of like super small, typically not very good conference, having one, you know, incredible team that was able to kind of rise above. So I think a two is on the table, especially if that number in the loss column is a zero or a one in particular. So yeah, we'll have to say I'm fascinated. I really truly am fascinated. I want to see Fairfield in the postseason, so I'm not wishing for this, but I would be fascinated to know if their only losses come in the Metro Atlantic tournament, what their at-large resume ends up being evaluated as.
As I recall, the MAAC is doing series in their tournament, right? So like that actually makes it far more likely that they avoid any sort of tournament upset.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, it's like basically kind of like the Patriot League does, I think, is my understanding of what they're doing. Yeah.
So that's, you know, over a couple weekends they're playing series, and that it's just going to be really hard for any of these teams to stop Fairfield. I mean, the second best team in the conference is probably Monmouth, and Fairfield has already swept them. So I don't see anyone stopping them. I probably would predict they would lose a game at some point here. Just it's baseball. Like, are they really going to be 40-0 in the regular season? And then I guess 44-0 if you throw in the conference tournament. Like, that just doesn't feel likely. But, you know, also, who knows? We'll see. We're on this ride together, folks. All right, Joe, we've talked a long time already, but I just want to briefly touch on UC Irvine beating Oregon State in what, for my money, was the best, most, or I shouldn't say the best, the most entertaining series of the weekend. I watched way more of this on ESPN3 than I would have anticipated going into it, but it was because the games were all so compelling, and also, like, frankly, I don't have a ton of opportunities to watch either Irvine or Oregon State as easily as I did this weekend. You know, I know I can go find the Pac-12 games on my computer, but it's just so much easier when I can just put them on the TV. Anyway, extra innings, walk-offs, like it was all there. Like, Oregon State had a great comeback on Friday. They didn't get a great start from Abel. They came back, won it in extras. And then Irvine walked off with wins the next two weekend or the next two games. And this was a matchup of what started teams that started the weekend in first place in the Big West and Pac-12. respectively. We didn't think Oregon State was the best Pac-12 team. I think that's been borne out here, not just with this loss, but also Arizona and Oregon by virtue of continuing to play in the conference. And Arizona swept USC, and Oregon won 2 out of 3 against UCLA. They have moved ahead of the Beavers now in the standings. I think that's appropriate for where teams relatively are in the Pac-12. But still, you know, Oregon State came into the weekend in first place in the Pac-12. Irvine sure seems like it's solidified itself as the best team in the Big West. And the Anteaters are legit, and I really, really enjoyed watching this series. So shouts to the Eaters and to the Beavs for putting on a great show this weekend at Irvine.
Yeah, it certainly goes up there. The other series I would nominate, because I'm with you, I watched some of this as well, just because they were so compelling. The other series I would put here is the season opening series between Tulane and the Raging Cajuns. That I think all three of those games went to extra innings. They were kind of wild. So those two series, I think, are the two most competitive series we've seen all season. I'm sure there's something out there that I'm missing because I just didn't see it. It wasn't on my radar. But
I mean, probably I wasn't thinking that big. But you know, you might be onto something here with this series and that series being two of the most competitive ones of the season. You're right. That I remember talking about that Tulane and ULL series. It was wild.
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, we've doubted like Tulane and UL being good or not. And now they both seem like they're some, you know, some version of being pretty good teams. So I think that adds a little bit to it, but anyway, back on point with UC Irvine, this team is kind of fascinating too, because it's not really built like UC Irvine so often is. Now the pitching is pretty good when it's on, but pitching has, if anything, maybe the rotation has actually been like not quite as good as you would have expected. And the offense has picked up a lot of that slack. This is actually on the spectrum of UC Irvine offenses. This is a pretty physical group. You know, Dylan Tatum, who hit a big home run in that series, 11 home runs on the year. Like, you just don't often see numbers like that in the home run column for a guy at UC Irvine. So I think it's a team that I think could compete well in the postseason, because so often we see these teams, pitching-centric teams from the Big West, they go to an environment where that style doesn't necessarily translate as well, and they really kind of struggle in that situation. And I think this is a team that is maybe equipped to be able to be a little more pliable with how they win games in the postseason.
Well, the highly unfortunate thing about this is that Irvine's probably ticketed to be the 2 in Tucson. So good luck with all of that. Yeah. But if they can somehow avoid that fate, you know, we'll – or maybe they can just go – bat for bat with the Wildcats. We'll see. But, regardless, impressive series win this weekend. We'll have plenty of time to analyze the Eaters' postseason prospects. But if they are able to finish in the Big West, and, you know, the Gauchos are sure look like the second best team, but they've been shaky at times this season. They've just played a really competitive series of their own at Long Beach State. That was a fun finish. Because they were playing an ESPNU. I honestly have no idea what channel I was watching at the end of last night. But they finished the night and they're playing extra innings. And if you weren't watching Dodgers Padres and you instead were watching Cho's Dirtbags, I think you made the right choice. That's what I'm going to tell myself anyway. And that was a pretty entertaining series. But again, Irvine hasn't been tested or pushed, I should say, to the extent that the Gauchos have been so far in Big West play this season. And you see that with the Big West record, with Irvine having a bit of a cushion there on first place. Those two teams will meet in a few weeks. So we'll get to see a play out on the field. But for right now, anyway, the Eaters sure look like the favorites in the Big West. All right, that's going to do it for us today on the Baseball America College Podcast. We covered an awful lot. It was a really fun weekend of college baseball around the country. There's plenty more over on the website if you want to check that out at baseballamerica.com. Joe and I will be back here later this week with another edition of the Baseball America College Podcast, previewing the weekend to come around the country, and talking about whatever other news items come up here over the rest of the week. So make sure you are subscribed to the Baseball America Podcast on your favorite podcasting app, be that Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Spotify. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can also find us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. Want to thank you all for listening. Thank you to Rapsodo for presenting this and every edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. For Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll see you next time.
Gary bought a trampoline online with Visa, so he has protection if his card is used fraudulently. Now Gary's feeling pretty confident. Confident enough to try a slam dunk from his trampoline.
Oh,
Gary. Visa's zero liability helps protect you from fraud. We just can't protect you from yourself. Search Visa How You Pay Matters to find out more. Commercial and anonymous prepaid cards excluded. Responsible card use required. Contact your bank for T&Cs.